My name is Lauren, L-O-R-E-N, Coleman, Lauren Coleman. I've lived in Maine for quite a while, and I'm known around the world more than actually in Maine as one of the leading living cryptozoologists, and I emphasize the living. So, you know, I have built a lot of my research and a lot of my writings on my mentors and other people that came before me, but starting in really the 70s, when I started writing prolifically, I've written 35 books, some with co-authors, some alone. I've traveled all over the United States to every state but Alaska, did an expedition to Loch Ness, been throughout Mexico and Canada investigating what are called cryptids, unknown animals, the responsibility of cryptozoology. And by cryptozoology, we mean the study of hidden or unknown animals that may actually turn into new species, new animals or rediscovered animals that supposedly were extinct. So it's an exciting field.
Yeah. To what extent is cryptozoology a science, and to what extent is it speculation and purely entertainment?
Well, I think that obviously when it was coined in the 1930s and 40s, cryptozoology was a subset of zoology, a subdiscipline of zoology. A lot of us in the field have a background in zoology, anthropology, as well as trying to understand the folklore, native traditions, and things like that. I think what happens with any kind of field that seems to be speculative, we have to have some theories or some direction for some of it. The entertainment business captures it. It becomes TV reality programs. It becomes graphic novels and comic books. It becomes part of the essence of society that is entertaining. Because cryptozoology really combines two passionate fields, an interest in animals and an interest in mysteries. So you put those two together and you're going to get a lot of people that, you know, all the way from the fringe to the more middle, like myself, which I'm skeptical but open-minded, to all the way at the other end, the debunkers. So you get both, you get both camps and all kinds of different things in between.
So you've been looking for the Loch Ness Monster, you've been looking for the Yeti. What have you seen over the years?
Well, I think that personally, I haven't seen that much. You know, I've interviewed hundreds of eyewitnesses. I'm really see myself as sort of a chronicler, a historian, a journalist, but also a field worker. So I've seen tracks of ape-like creatures in North America. I've certainly seen that some things at Loch Ness that weren't monsters, but told me a lot about how people were perceiving. For instance, I never knew that there was a thing called the Har, which is a fog that rolls on the top of Loch Ness, and how I can really see how some people look at that fog and they see monsters. Mm-hmm. So that is very, compelling to me.
So despite your commitment to cryptozoology, I mean, you do bring a skeptical eye. You're not going to believe every folklore that's out there.
Oh, 80% of what comes to my desk, what comes to my field of vision, are hoaxes, mistakes, misidentifications, with misidentifications being the number one thing. I get called by the media all the time asking me to look at a picture and say, what is this chupacabras? And I say, well, that's nothing but a raccoon, that's nothing but a dog, something with mange. Most of these things that are brought to my attention are ones in which I can easily explain, and yes, I'm very skeptical.
Zoology has had some notable successes, some animals that have been discovered that were previously unknown about. There's the okapi, that sort of zebra-type-looking thing in Africa, and the fish beginning with C that I can't pronounce.
The coelacanth. And the coelacanth is actually our logo animal here at the museum. We actually have a cabinet at the International Cryptozoology Museum of what we call the animals of discovery. The okapi is one of them, the giant panda, the mountain gorilla, the giant squid. These are animals that were large. They had a great body of folklore around them. The giant squid, for instance, is the kraken. Mm-hmm. And even the giant panda reports were, even though the Chinese knew about a black and white bear, Western science didn't believe them. And it wasn't until 1936 the Ruth Harkness brought out the first giant panda cub. So a lot of these discoveries are very recent. A lot of people don't realize that actually this year a very large animal was found in Brazil, the fifth species of tapir. There are four species that we've known about, and not until 2014 did we discover the fifth species. What's incredibly interesting about that is it's a cryptozoological species because the native people knew about it for hundreds of years, and actually after this one was discovered, it was found that 100 years ago, Teddy Roosevelt shot one, and there's one stuffed in a museum. And nobody realized that it was a new species.
At the museum in Brazil?
No, actually, it's the American Museum of Natural History.
So all those years, there was a cryptid under everyone's noses, and people didn't know.
Exactly.
Are there any others that are out there that you think we're on the cusp of discovering that you're particularly excited about?
Well, I think that I'm always asked, you know, the best bets or what's at the top of the list that's going to be discovered. And everybody wants the Loch Ness Monster or the Bigfoot or Yeti. I think we have to really be much more conservative. The one that I think will shock anthropology and really get people excited again is the Arang Pindek, and that's in Sumatra in Indonesia. There's been reports of these consistently for hundreds of years. It's a little ape-like creature that's about 3.5-4 feet tall, covered with hair. Looks kind of like an orangutan, but they always walk upright. So it seems to be one of these kinds of primates, great apes, that would be between an orangutan and between a little short person. Mm-hmm. So
the missing link, almost.
Well, we don't use that word, certainly it excites people. And Arang Pindek in the language of Sumatra just means short person. Yeah. So it's already kind of more a hominid than it is a hominoid or anthropoid.
Okay. So the best known ones that everyone knows, Loch Ness Monster, but do you think it's false or true?
Oh, well, I don't use the word fossil true. I accept or deny the evidence, and I think that for the Loch Ness Monster, a lot of it is waves, misidentification, water birds. And I would say of all of the lake monsters around the world, there's only a 50-50 chance that there's a lake monster there. The one thing that Loch Ness has going for it is it's an extremely large lake. There's enough water in Loch Ness to bury everyone on Earth under 6 feet of water. It's enormous. It goes down 1,000 feet. The other thing, it's only 6 miles from the ocean, and there's been about 40 reports of the Loch Ness Monster crossing land, sort of like a giant walrus, a giant slug-like creature. So we may have a creature that's not in Loch Ness all the time, even a breeding population that's not there, but is in the ocean and comes back and forth.
An amphibious monster. That,
yes, yeah. Definitely.
Bigfoot, your thoughts on that?
Bigfoot, there's a little more chance. There's many more reports. I think that we have what I call a cultural Bigfoot. You have shows on TV in which they're going out looking for Bigfoot in Rhode Island or New Hampshire or Connecticut. I think that's a cultural Bigfoot. There's really probably not an actual biological creature there. The best evidence for Bigfoot seems to be from Northern California to Southern Alaska, British Columbia, on Oregon, those places. You get very consistent reports of animals, large primate animals, interacting with humans for hundreds of years. The native art's there. You find footprints, fecal material, hair samples, a real consistent bits of evidence, some of which through DNA testing have come back inconclusive. So there's a lot of hope there. A lot of other reports, even in Maine, Michigan, Minnesota, there was maybe interlopers from Quebec and Northern Canada, but they're not residents here. So I'm open-minded about it, but most of the reports that I find are people making mistakes.
Mm-hmm. What about Yeti? I know you have a couple of Yeti-related exhibits in here.
Yes. We have fecal material from the 1959 and 1958 expeditions. We have hair samples. I've been very interested in Yeti. And actually, the Yeti, the Abominable Snowman, brought me into the field in 1960, and I've been doing it since then and have wrote a biography of Tom Slick, a multimillionaire who funded expeditions. I think that there's a chance that some of the Yeti may have gone extinct in some of the range. The recent DNA sampling where of hundreds of samples of Yeti, they found that there's actually probably a type of polar bear slash brown bear that is getting confused in some of those. To find that new species would be just as exciting as finding a new species of primate. But I think, like with Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, the evidence is enormous for us to be interested in it, but it may not be that there's that much there. The other thing, it's a cultural phenomenon now. I mean, you have most Americans think that Yetis are white, and that is really because of one cultural item, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Most of the native peoples and myself and other scientists that have studied it know that the Yeti are reddish brown to black.
Do they have bad teeth?
Probably, because of their diet.
the one in the Rudolph film had bad teeth.
You needed a dentist.
So let's talk about Maine. You mentioned it'd been connected with possible Bigfoot sightings. I've heard about sea monsters being talked about last in the 19th century in the Casco Bay, and certain species that aren't extinct but are thought to have left but may have come back, like mountain lion that haven't been seen for 70 years. And what are your thoughts on what's going on here?
Well, let's start with the sea serpents. Nowadays, everybody talks about Yeti, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster. The other fourth cryptid that was the big celebrity cryptid, as I call it, was the sea serpents off the coast of Maine. But they are not just 18th century, 19th century. There have been, as recently as 2007, some good sightings off of the coast. There was an incident where some people were in a pleasure boat, and they were doing their good deeds, and they saw some garbage bags off floating off on the horizon. They went over to them, and those garbage bags swam away. It was a sea serpent, and it's usually there's these hump-like protuberances sort of out of the water and maybe a little head. There was even a recent sighting off of Mount Desert Island just last summer. So there are still sightings going on. There's a good chance the water, I mean, the ocean is the best location for new data. It's vast. It's unknown. People don't get that close. There's not fecal material and footprints, so it's much more amorphous. And we know that there's probably 25 new species to be discovered in the next 50 years in the ocean. People will label some of them sea serpents, and you know, there'll be discovery there. The mountain lions seem to be coming back. They're coming back from Canada. Mountain lions, the tanned colored ones, the ones that look deer-like. The hidden phenomena as far as cryptozoology in Maine is about 40% of all the reports that we hear from New Brunswick, Labrador, and Maine are of black panthers. And there is no zoological black mountain lion. There are no populations of black leopards, or black jaguars in Maine or New England. But you consistently get people in broad daylight with good lighting or in the headlights of their cars saying they see black panthers. They're bigger than Fisher, you know, which are the little weasel-like creatures. They're bigger than a Labrador dog or a chocolate lab. So there's something else going on, and we don't exactly know what it is, but I've had police officers, I've had helicopter pilots coming through the museum, people that have been looking for Alzheimer's victims and see a black panther, you know, in that same wooded area. So I've even had some people that are Border Patrol say that they've seen some of these. So there's something going on. We're just not sure what it is.
Where would you expect to see black panthers in the globe? Where's their indigenous?
Well, the indigenous black leopards are in Asia and in Africa. Black jaguars are in South America. You have no black mountain lions in the known zoological taxidermy, so that would be a brand new animal.
Tell us about this museum. I know you've had the museum 11 years. It's moved from location to location as you've acquired more exhibits, and we're now at this one just off Congress Street. Tell us about the range of exhibits you've got here. We'll go and have a look at them in a moment, but just briefly, kind of describe if you could.
Sure. Well, since Bigfoot is the most popular, we have a real concerted effort to get some good Bigfoot exhibits here. We have over 200 casts of Bigfoot from around North America. We have an 8.5-foot-tall, 500-pound model of a Bigfoot made by a taxidermist in Wisconsin. And then we have other creatures like representatives of sea serpents. There was a sea serpent, a juvenile one, that was about 14 foot long, found in the stomach of a sperm whale. We have an exact model of that. We have other things like the capra, which are little Japanese creatures, and most people know them as the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. That's how culturally they've come down to us. And it's really separated into one room, which we see as the evidence room, where the fecal material, hair samples, casts, some films, some other items that are related to expeditions and reality, some reality TV shows like a trail cam from the Monster Quest TV program are out in one room. And then you have what we call the art and popular culture room, where we actually track the chronology of Bigfoot through toys and cultural items. We look at other specific areas like Africa, where there's cryptids there like Mokelia Mbembe and other things. Then there's the chupacabras and various things from South America and Latin America. So we try to regionalize it as well and give people a good overview of what cryptozoology. There's over 10,000 items in the museum. It really is based upon my collecting, which started in 1960, and then donations. When I opened the museum in 2003, people just wanted to donate things. And one of the missions of is, of course, to educate and to share, but also to preserve what we were finding in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, is people were dying. You know, people die. They die early sometimes. And their parents or nobody that knew about their expeditions or respected them in the way that cryptozoologists and zoologists and anthropologists do, they were actually throwing whole collections in dumpsters. So we saw it as a way to model saving and preserving these important historical documents and artifacts. Not so much that we wanted everybody to donate them just to us, but it served as a model. Give them to your local university, your alumni, your local historical society, and don't neglect that this is an important part of our history, especially in science.
Mm-hmm. So in the museum, there's a clear delineation between what would be more scientific exhibits that contribute towards the debate in a rational way and items of purely for entertainment and cultural value.
Right, yeah. We tried to separate it out in rooms. Of course, what happens with any limited space is you start using the walls and overlapping and getting those display cases. So even in the art room now, there's cases that have legitimate information on African or Latin American material too. But of course, since we don't have an actual cryptid that's... Because once an animal is discovered, it becomes part of zoology. Yeah. Because we don't have actual Bigfoot or Loch Ness Monster in the museum, we have to rely on cultural items.
As a scientific person, does it sometimes frustrate you that the subject is used for sort of titillation or, you know, lighthearted entertainment?
Well, because of my history in the field, because I've been in the field for, you know, almost 55 years now, oh, my goodness, it's getting 57 years. I'm 67,
okay.
So I started very young. And what I've seen is that it's been scientific, and then people become interested, and there's this explosion in the entertainment and the culture and the fun. We're in, you know, there's cryptids in video games now. That didn't exist in 1960. There weren't video games. So you see a real explosion in the entertainment, and you see it in more movies, and that's just fine.
But it contributes to the debate.
It contributes also to people. If they hear about something, then they backtrack and start reading about it and study it more scientifically, and that helps.